The first case to be heard this morning is number 2008-2365, Board of Education Worthington City Schools versus Franklin County Board of Revision. We have counsel here this morning. Sit at council table. The appellant in the case is Weber Sisters Enterprises. Mr. Petkovic.
Master Commissioner, if it please the court, I'd like to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Please watch your time.
Yes, sir. This cause and matters before the court on an appeal filed from a determination of the Ohio Board of Tax Appeals dated November 12, 2008. This case has somewhat of a history. For the tax year 2003, the Board of Education filed a complaint with regard to a 1031 tax-free exchange of the subject real estate between two entities.
That was a complaint as to tax year 2003.
Yes, sir.
And the sale occurred in May of 2003. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I believe that to be the time. The subject property are two strip center buildings that are about 7,500 square feet apiece, located 17179 East Campus View Boulevard in Worthington. In the course of the tax-free exchange, and this is a testimony at the Board of Revision as well as the documentary evidence, there were certain averments made by the entity that owned that particular property prior to the 1031 exchange. There were certain documents provided in terms of projected tenancy and commitments to lease. None of those ever came to fruition, and the record is fraught with what was wrong with the averments and essentially how my clients got snookered in terms of the exchange. But one of the, and it's noted in our brief, one of the tenants was there for approximately a year and a half and never did pay rent. And it took an extended period of time to get Judge Shure to the Franklin County Common Pleas Court to evict those people. They never did recoup any of the monies. Essentially what happened was the Board of Education filed a complaint for 2003. The Board of Revision decided not to apply that sale price because the building was not in a completed status as of the tax lien date 1-1-2003. That hearing was held in 2004. For the tax year 2004, the Board of Education again filed a complaint with regard to the 1031 transfer of the property. Now, between the date of the Board of Revision hearing and the tax lien date January 1, 2004, the county auditor conducted an appraisal of the property. The county auditor had available, and it's noted on the property record cards that the county had as part of the statutory transcript, with regard to the original sale price of the land, the amount of the building permits, et cetera. Now, at that particular hearing for the 2004 tax year, one of the principals.
Let me go back to that. So the auditor then put a new value for the property down.
As a completed property.
As completed.
Yes, sir.
Now was that the only basis for the change that the auditor made, as far as you know?
Yes.
Okay.
The auditor was aware of the fact that it was an incompleted property for 2003, pursuant to his duties as prescribed by the Administrative Code in Chapter 5713 of the Revised Code. He was required to place a value on the property as a completed property. That the auditor did, and it was from that value determination pursuant to the auditor's appraisal that the Board of Education in this instance filed on with regard to 2004. I know that sounds disjointed, but so essentially you had a brand new value placed on the property by the auditor. At the Board of Revision hearing, the same conveyance forms that were presented in the 2003 case were presented in the 2004 case. In 2003, they declined to use the sale as evidence, that being the fact that it wasn't completed as of that date. In 2004, that particular case, the Board of Revision rejected that sale as the auditor had already done an independent valuation and had this other information that he used, which is all a matter of record in the county's transcript. At that particular hearing, one of the principals in the transaction for Weber Sisters, and originally it was Bob O'Link Incorporated, testified with regard to the problems in renting the property, that when they realized that these averments of fact were not going to come to fruition, that these tenants weren't taking the spaces, that they had about a 45% to 50% vacancy factor in this building that they got. Not being local investors, they decided to put on the market, and there's testimony in the record with regard to the failure of that to get rid of the property at some reasonable level. In addition, financial information and leases and rent rolls, et cetera, were provided at the Board of Revision hearing with regard to that. Subsequently, the Board of Revision determined that they were not going to change the value from that, independently determined by the auditor with regard to the tax lien date 1104. That matter was appealed by the Board of Education to the Board of Tax Appeals. The matter was set for hearing at the Board of Tax Appeals. The Board of Education waived hearing, and the matter was submitted on the record. Now, one of the issues, and I would point the court to the determination in January 23 of 2007 in the Dayton Montgomery County Port Authority case. At page 8, this court said, under all these circumstances, it became the burden of the county or the school board to rebut the sufficiency of the Port Authority's evidence as to both points. And they cite Mentor Exempted Village Schools versus Lake County, 37 Ohio State, 3rd, 318. And the court went on to say, since none of the appellees presented evidence on either point, the Port Authority's evidence stands unrebutted in the record. In the same decision at page 9, this court said, the common thread running through these cases consists of, one, the presentation of evidence by the party who challenges the Board of Revision's determination, two, the tendency of that evidence to undermine or contradict the Board of Revision's determination, and three, the absence of evidence offered in rebuttal. And that's precisely what you have in this particular instance. The school board presented neither any testimony nor evidence with regard to that, but simply asserted that the sale was the only evidence. Now,
what precisely was it that the school board needed to rebut? And as my understanding is, they presented the presented the conveyance fee statement and the deed and said, mm-hmm. This is a sale price. It's a recent arm's length sale price. What sort of evidence would they need to put on to support their position?
This court discussed some of that in specific detail in a case called Cummings Property Services Incorporated versus Board of Revision, which was a case I argued here in front of the full court. And in that particular case, the Supreme Court indicated in its determination that, number one, there is an affirmative burden of proof on the person asserting the sale. Two, anyone not in accord with that has a concomitant burden of proof. Here you have this intervening separate determination of value by the county auditor, so it's not purely necessarily in that context, but the court seems to indicate and indicated in questions from the justices with regard to the issue of a sale being a prima facie type of evidence. The Board of Tax Appeals perceives a transaction involving a transfer of real estate, no matter what nature or what other attendant circumstances are involved, as being an absolute as opposed to prima facie. Now, admittedly, 5713.03 or 02 indicates that a sale is the best evidence of value, but in this particular case, there was a great deal of other evidence in addition to the auditor's independent appraisal of the property that militated against that sale.
And that evidence goes to, in your view, to, does it go to the arm's length nature of the sale, the recency of the sale? How does that evidence controvert the propriety of using the sale price to value the property?
Well, first of all, you have an instance where you have a 1031 exchange. And inherent in those type of transactions, it's not an open market situation. It's supposed to be, ideally under the Internal Revenue Code, a transfer in a quid pro quo situation of equal things between equals. And in this particular instance, the evidence very clearly pointed out that that wasn't the case, that there were other things that went with it. Now, in the recent decision of this court in HK New Plan Exchange Property Owners versus Cincinnati School District and Hamilton County Board of Revision, and it was just decided July 28th of this year, the court goes into some discussion in detail what happens when a sale is rejected and that there's a concomitant affirmative burden of proof. In the Cummings case, the Supreme Court said that there is no reversal of the burden of proof, and that seems to be the tenet in a couple of the recent cases that this court has decided. Now, in this particular instance, with an independent determination of value by the auditor, which was affirmed by the Board of Revision, the school board, having filed an appeal, had a concomitant burden of going forward to establish that the sale militated against all the other evidence. The Board of Tax Appeals, quite interestingly, and this is one of the foundations that was the basis of our appeal, the Board of Tax Appeals at page 2 and 3 of its decision and 4 of its decision goes into some same reiteration of what they put in virtually every decision they make in terms of the burden of proof and the burden of going forward and all the Supreme Court citations that are applicable to that particular theory, which we are not contesting whether that's the absolute and fundamentally sound way that it should be viewed. But notwithstanding the fact that they go through all this, that the appellant bears the burden of proof, at page 5 of their decision, the Board of Tax Appeals says, however, the property owner presented no competent or probative evidence challenging the arm's length nature of the 2000 sale before either the Board of Revision or this board to rebut the presumption that the sale price best evidence of value. But they're talking about an affirmative burden of proof on the person going forward as an appellant, and that there is no shifting of this burden of proof, or as this court said, I believe it was at page 18 of its decision in Cummings, that there is no requirement on the other party to prove a negative. So in this particular instance, the Board of Revision determined that the auditor's value was correct. In going forward on an appeal with regard to that, it would be incumbent then on the school board to produce some type of evidence affirmatively showing that its position was correct. And that's what's lacking in this case. Now, the Board of Tax Appeals, in a 6-page decision, 2/3 of which is the reiteration of the legal principles in terms of burden of proof, then didn't even look at the record that was established at the Board of Revision, the financial documents, the testimony of the principal. So, you know.
Let me ask you a couple questions real quick about the issues that are before us. There was an allusion to whether or not the school board's complaint for tax year 2004 was a second complaint within the interim period.
Yes.
Are you asserting that as grounds for that complaint should have been dismissed?
Well, of recent vintage, this court has rejected the collateral estoppel and stare decisis type of issues with regard to the difference from one tax year to another. So I personally feel that those principles apply.
Okay. But well, let's view those separately for a second. Got to use up some time here, but I need to realize what issues are before us. On the one hand, there's the question of whether or not this is a second filed complaint. Do you think that is a reason why there was no jurisdiction to for the BOR to entertain that complaint. There was some argumentation about that in the case.
Yeah, but the Board of Revision, no Board of Revision ever perceives that they are limited by that.
Okay.
Specifically with regard to, in the same triennial, you have to remember that the 2003 tax year case was filed by law 5715-19 on or before the 31st day of March 2004.
Mm-hmm.
You had a hearing in 2004 on 2003. The 2004 case was filed on or before the 31st day of March 2005.
Right.
So this sale was already, you know, out there. The property had
and
had
the school
exposure
board,
time
the
to
school
the market
board,
for 2 years.
The school board was using the sale in the first complaint, and then they were using the sale in the second complaint.
Right.
So does that create a problem or not?
Well, our problem with that is that, number one, there's the identity of issues, identity of parties.
Okay.
And that those things were present.
So that issue is before us?
I believe it to be.
Okay.
And that was one issue raised in our appeal.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Petkovic.
You, sir.
Mr. Rich.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. This is a very simple case. We had a sale of property in May of 2003 for $4,175,000. The Board of Education filed a complaint, as we've indicated and as we've heard about, in 2003, but the property was unfinished and the Board of Revision properly didn't use the sale price. They settled at a value of, for 03, of $2,011,000. Now, in 2004, instead of using the sale price, which they knew about, and the sale which they knew about, what they did is they set the value for 2004 and carried it over to 2005 at $2,680,000, in spite of the fact that they had a sale price of $4,175,000. Now, because the auditor changed the value from 03 to 04, and because there was a substantial improvement added between January 1, 2003 and 2004, we, as the Board of Education, had a right to file a second complaint, which we did, affirming that the law is very clear that the auditor should have used the sale price. And when the Board of Revision failed to change the value, we appealed to the Board of Tax Appeals, which properly recognized that if, in fact, as you have discussed already, the one complaint every triennial period rule were enforced here, when the auditor had changed the value, that would eliminate the right of anyone to file a complaint on a changed value during a triennial period, and that was not the intent of the statutory regulation, nor was there a prohibition against filing a complaint during a three-year period when there is a substantial improvement, and obviously there was here. So the Board of Tax Appeals found jurisdiction. They then used the sale price, and of course the owner of the property appealed to this honorable court. So as far as we're concerned, this is a Berea case. This is a very simple case. It's about whether or not the sale price should be the value of the property.
What about the 1031 like kind exchange?
Well,
how does that affect the analysis?
That's all nice, except they didn't argue it. It wasn't. I went through the notice of appeal very carefully, and there was no mention of it. And of course, this court has ruled that if you don't raise it in the notice of appeal, you can't argue it. Moreover, there were a couple arguments that were in the notice of appeal. For example, he mentioned, my esteemed counsel there mentioned the case Montgomery-Dayton. It was mentioned in the notice of appeal. But then in his brief, I went through, they failed to cite it. And you have also held that if you mention an item in your notice of appeal, if you're appealing something, but then you fail to argue it, you waive it. So when we get down to the bottom line, what they've actually raised in their notice of appeal and argued, aside from the more than one filing during a triennial period, is this burden of proof argument, which is totally spurious. The burden of proof when a party, whether it's a school board or an owner, files the deed and a conveyance fee of value automatically means that there has been an arm's length sale, and those parties who seek to set it aside have that burden to set it aside. They failed to do so. They failed to offer any evidence that would rebut that.
Well, now, there was evidence offered at the BOR, which the BOR seemed to find persuasive with respect to tenants abandoning the property. Now, does that affect either the recency or the arm's length character?
Absolutely not. What happens if they got more tenants than they thought they should have? the Supreme Court of Ohio in the Berea case and many other cases, but that's the most important one in recent years, has set an objective standard. I know he cited the Cummins case. I lost that case. We tried to chip away at that objective standard on a case that we thought we'd absolutely win. If there was any chance they'd chip away at it, they said, no, we're not going to look at anything else. There's an objective standard. The only reason you do appraisals is when you don't have an objective standard. An appraisal is just to try to figure out what would a property sell for in an arm's length transaction. If you have an arm's length transaction, the deal is closed, the case is decided, that is the value of property.
Does the whether or not the 1031 is separately an issue, does that bear on the arm's length character, the sale, this open market idea?
Not at all. The testimony, in fact, in this case, we went through the transcript just a couple days ago to see if the witness testified at the Board of Revision, and that was the only place evidence was taken. Did this lady testify that she felt she was under duress or she had to force herself to do the sale, or that the 1031 did anything to her opinion as to what she paid for the property? There was no testimony whatsoever, just testimony that it was a 1031 exchange, not that it had any effect on the sale price. Without that testimony, the Board of Tax Appeals and the Board of Revision couldn't have even considered the 1031 as relevant, and of course it was never raised in the Notice of Appeal.
Does the evidence support, I believe counsel used the word snookered here this morning, does the evidence support an inference that the current owners were misled when they purchased the property?
No, not at all. There's nothing, as I said, there's nothing in the Board of Revision transcript, which is the only evidentiary transcript, where people say, oh boy, were we snookered. Oh boy, did we make a bad deal. Even if there were, unless there was fraud involved, I can't see any way that this honorable court would consider any chipping away at the objective standard sale price equals market value for real property tax purposes. So we don't see that they have raised any issues before this court in their notice of appeal and argued those issues in the brief that have any effect on chipping away that standard. Moreover, we feel that the complaint that we filed was a lawful complaint. It was properly heard by the Board of Tax Appeals in its decision, and they reversed the Board of Revision using the sale price. And therefore, we believe that there's no other issues in this case, and that the decision was reasonable, it was lawful, and it should be affirmed by this court.
Does the abandonment of leases by the tenants, as a matter of law, have no effect on the value of the property? I mean, it's conceivable that, and of course, there was some evidence of later attempts to resell the property that were unsuccessful at the price that was being demanded. I mean, and wouldn't the property be more likely to sell for a higher price if those tenants were there on the tax lien date?
Maybe, maybe not. We don't know. That's why this court established an objective standard. They're not going to guess. What happens if they brought in a tenant immediately after the sale who paid a lot more than they thought when they did their pro formas on purchasing the property? Does that mean the value should increase above the sale price? This court has said, we're not going to get into those details. That's not important. There's an objective standard. Sometimes you make a good deal. Sometimes you make a bad deal. Sometimes you make the deal that you thought you were going to make. In any event, as shown in the Cummings case, that's the sale price. That's all I have, Your Honor. If there's any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you. None.
Thank you, Mr. Rich. Mr. Petkovic, you've reserved 14 seconds. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you. I disagree with counsel's analysis of the Cummings case. This court said that a sale is prima facie, and that it's not a bright line absolute, as counsel would infer. In addition, the particular instance here, in answer to a lot of your questions, counsel's response was, I don't know, what if? The fact of the matter is that the separate determination of the Board of Revision having been made and the Board of Education having filed a notice of appeal placed squarely upon the shoulders of the Board of Education a burden of going forward. And once they declined to exercise their right to have a hearing to present evidence in support of their appeal, as the court indicated and I read to you, That record below became the sole aspect of the Board of Tax Appeals review, and there being nothing to refute that evidence by way of.
And just so we're clear, the evidence that we're talking about is the evidence that relates to, excuse me, the abandonment of property by or the leases by the tenants, subsequent attempts to sell the property that were unsuccessful, and so forth.
The financial statements, the income and expense statements, the other testimony with regard to the condition of the building. Some of that space was never built out, if you will. It became shell space and remained shell space.
And it's your contention.
People weren't going to take it.
And it's your contention that that evidence did show that there might have been a decline in value by the next tax lien date.
Well, the fact of the matter is that once the Board of Revision made its decision, it's incumbent on somebody to disprove that. That wasn't done. The information that came up by virtue of the statutory transcript to the Board of Tax Appeals not being refuted and the Board of Education not going forward with the case that it filed, that became something that was unquestionable, as the court has indicated. Now, for the Board of Tax Appeals to have overturned the determination of the Franklin County Board of Revision, it would have had to reiterate what evidence it found salient in terms of overturning that. It didn't do that. It said, well, you have all this burden of proof on an appellant, on and on and on. And then when you get to page 5, they reverse that burden of proof to the taxpayer who was not the appellant in the first instance.
And I guess my concern is, given the case law and so forth, what sort of evidence would the school board have had to bring to the BTA in order to satisfy that burden? Would it have been an appraisal, and would that be consistent with the case law?
It very well could have in that instance, even though the court said when you're dealing with a sale, you can't use appraisal evidence to refute an arm's length sale. In this particular instance, admittedly, and the county so found that there was something wrong with this sale, or that conditions had severely changed from the date of the 1031 transfer to the tax lien date in issue. That being supported by the evidence of the taxpayer being financial statements, rent rolls, direct testimony of one of the principals that ran the property, etc. So none of that was refuted.
And as I recall, the only thing the BTA said about the question of whether the sale was recent was that it was close in time. It was like May 03.
Well, it's recent because not that many monthly pages have been flipped on the calendar, but whether or not it's recent, there are other indicia that point to an arm's length sale. One of them being open market and the other one being no change in circumstances. This court has also noted one of those circumstances in Cummings is a change in the financial conditions or economics with regard to the property. So we're looking at a vastly different animal for 2004 and 2005 than when this brand new property with virtually nobody in it transferred.
Thank you, Mr. Peckovic.
Thank you for your indulgence for giving me extra time, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Peckovic. This case will be submitted, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.